I mean, that's true of all of us comedians, but it seemed to burn even brighter in her. At the tribute, Gilbert Gottfried was there, Dick Cavett, Bob Saget, and many others. We all told favorite Joan jokes. I recited Joan's line that Elizabeth Taylor was so fat, a ship broke a bottle over her. I think Joan's legacy in the comedy world is profound, as a trailblazer for women and just an incredibly funny person. I appreciate the greats, the history, and what came before. One of my biggest regrets is declining an invitation years ago to be on a Bob Hope special. What the hell was I thinking? He was such a big influence on my joke telling, especially that timing of his. And now it's too late. As he would say, "Louie, I want to tell you, you should have done it, kid." They're all gone, Mom. Not that I expect the old guard would be around forever. But we all get nostalgic, and it makes me think of how I fell in love with comedy and comedians to begin with. I remember watching The Tonight Show with Dad. I was such a big fan of Jack Benny's. I love the comedy of Jonathan Winters and Richard Pryor and the late, great Jackie Vernon, who is sort of a sad sack, which is what my characters teeter on often. I used to do mostly one-liners, just fat jokes, so it was a fat character, very deliberate and efficient in the delivery, like Hope. You know, I developed my skills at Mickey Finn's in Minneapolis, a tiny locals bar on Third and Central. If you blinked, you'd walk right by it. That's where I grew up with other young comics like Jeff Gerbino, Alex Cole, Jeff Cesario, Scott Hansen, Joel Hodgson, Liz Winstead, Bill Bauer. It was an exciting comedy and performance scene in Minneapolis, a city with more theater seats per capita than anywhere but New York City. That's what they say. I don't know if anyone has ever proved it. Very sophisticated audiences, Mom, just like you. Who knew that you and Dad would pick a city to live in after Kansas City that actually was pretty ideal for comedy? Would I have ended up doing comedy if I had grown up in South Dakota? Twin Cities audiences give you a fair shot. Though, if they don't think you're funny, they won't laugh. Jimmy Walker was also a great supporter of me. He got Mitzi Shore, the owner of the Comedy Store in L.A., to watch my set in 1982. And then I got my big shot on The Tonight Show in 1984, and Johnny had me back a whole bunch of times over the next year. Eventually, I got a great agent who represented, among others, Bob Hope, Marlene Dietrich, and Johnny Mathis. And he started getting me gigs. I got more notice. I opened for lots of huge music acts. Chuck Berry. My first words to him were, "Hey, Chuck." He quickly corrected me with "Mr. Berry." And Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and the Commodores, the Pointer Sisters, Smokey Robinson, Natalie Cole, Glen Campbell, and Ray Charles. That was mostly in Las Vegas, and I was doing well. When I ran into Joan around this time, I remember her saying, "Isn't the money good?" I was about to reply, "Oh, money doesn't really mean anything," but that would have been a lie. There are things that come with being a comedian that I hadn't thought about much or like very much. That is, besides the occasional task of having to follow on stage a young Robin Williams or an Eddie Murphy or a young Sam Kennison, there's also the choice of a path to take when you become successful. One path might be more lucrative, one more honest, though for some performers, they might be one in the same path. I don't know. But those performers are willing to say, "I don't care if you like me or not. This is what I want to talk about." Those are my comedy heroes, the ones who care more about being respected than liked. I was a poor fat kid who wanted to be liked, no matter what, and I wanted to have enough money not to worry about it. The money was good. The money did matter. In the end, there's nothing more satisfying than when somebody comes up to me and tells me that something I said resonated with them. Some joke or routine from 20 years ago made them laugh so hard they nearly peed. Or actually peed, which is better. Or even made them want to do stand-up. When I hear that, I smile. I'm glad I worked hard on that joke, or that bit, or that set. Of course, comedy is a tough life, and let's face it, Mom, we're a pretty screwed-up bunch of people. Comics are sad sacks and volcanoes and damaged goods. A TV producer once said to me, I didn't realize until I was working with so many comedians the level of self-loathing. Does any group hate themselves more? Let me check and get back to you on that. I joked, but I think she's right. Comedians are complicated people. Mom, I don't hate myself. At least nowhere near the degree I used to. Still, I think it's a mean stew. You know how when you burn a stew or soup, even if it's edible, you can always still taste the part that's burned, that bitter taste. That's us. That part that never leaves. There's a helpless, debilitating place. So we need to make people laugh so we can get all the love we can, and maybe enough laughs and love will cleanse us, like a good body cleanse, even a juice cleanse. Who knows, though? Some people question the whole life that goes into it and whether it's worth it. After I got some national attention, the mother of an up-and-coming Minnesota stand-up comedian wrote me a letter begging me to call her very funny, very talented son and convince him not to become a comic. What was I supposed to do, call him and say, don't follow your passion? Call the mom and say, well, it's not the worst job in the world. I did neither. You have to figure it out for yourself. Love, Louie. Nominee. Hey, Mom. People have been talking for the last 5 or 6 months about how I'm going to win an Emmy for Best Supporting Actor in a comedy because of my portrayal of Christine Baskets. It's nice to hear, but hold on, folks. We're getting way ahead of things. Anyway, this morning was when they announced the nominees, but I couldn't find it, not on TV nor on the Internet. I went to the Television Academy website and didn't find it there either, so I started to doubt myself until I got a ton of calls and texts and emails from my friend Abraham, my manager Amos, my publicist Glenn and Eve Schwartz. I don't know if it was inside information or they just figured out how to track it down when I didn't. Maybe I was just too nervous. But there it was, finally, on the Emmy site. I got one of the 7 nominations for Best Supporting Actor in a Comedy. Yes! I mean, yes. It feels wonderful, I can't lie. I read my name over and over in slow motion. My competition I know well from the comedy world, or from their great TV work. Andre Brower from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Ty Burrell from Modern Family, Tony Hale and Matt Walsh from Veep, Keegan-Michael Key from Key and Peele, and of course Titus Burgess from The Incredible Kimmy Schmidt, or Unstoppable Kimmy Schmidt, or The Irrepressible Kimmy Schmidt. You'd like them all, Mom, but you'd love Titus because he sings, he's sweet, and he has a way about him. Now I just have to wait 2 months until the night of the Emmys, September 18th, which means that everyone will hopefully be saying congratulations for the next 2 months. Which is way better than saying you got robbed, so that part's great. And, if I'm being honest, which why wouldn't I be with you, Mom? I love that I worked really hard on the part of Christine. I think I'm making people feel differently with the character. I hope they laugh, but I know they're also feeling lots of things because I am, too. If they weren't, and I wasn't, then why bother doing the show? With Christine Baskets, I put myself in your position as a mother. I put myself in your position as a wife. I put myself in the position of a woman who's been through a lot, seen a lot, who feels everything, and who tries to right all the wrongs in her life and everyone else's lives, too. Who tries to take care of her children. All the things you did, Mom. And I keep one thing in mind during all the tough moments for this character in the show. Every time I have a turn where I must decide, should I be mad or happy or sad? I think of you. I keep in mind your incredible humanity, your depth. I'm telling you, Mom, you're really something. People think that I'm suddenly a great actor, but I'm just playing you. I believe that I have a lot of your qualities, but I can't say that I am the sole creator and author of this character. I would say it's you and me, and we're in it together. And all my sisters and brothers, and so many other people, even Dad. You have added the most by a long shot. Your wonderful outlook on things, no matter how down and out you were. The ability to find a silver lining, no matter how dark. I'm happy to play you, Mom. because I'm playing someone who is real, loving, and caring. You're always just a nuance away, Mom. Louis. You gave away a child or two. Hey, Mom. Guess what I got in the mail today from Aunt Shirley? Some brooches that belong to Aunt Iona, and maybe you, I don't even know. I'm going to pick out the best one and wear it to the Emmys next week. Iona had good taste like you did. It runs in the family. You were so good to your sister Iona. I always had some questions about that, Mom, which I wish I would have asked about in a deeper way when I could have. After you gave birth to Shanna, child number 6, exactly a year to the day after child number 5, Jimmy, was born, you must have felt overwhelmed. Kent, Rhea, Mary, Roger, Jimmy, just 1 year old, and now, one more mouth to feed, more diapers to change, Dad drinking more, growing angrier, becoming more unreliable as a provider, and Iona had a tubal pregnancy years before and couldn't have children. Let's face it, Mom, you were the champ of having children. When Shanna was 6 months old, you gave her to your sister so that she would have a daughter. I know Aunt Iona and Uncle Ike already had an adopted son, Bradley. Shanna went to live with them in South Dakota and really wasn't our sister anymore. She was and she wasn't. But you know the family photograph from around 1947, where Shanna's about 4 years old, and they came to visit, and all the Anderson kids are lined up against the brick wall, everyone but Lisa, me, and Tommy, who didn't exist yet. And little Shanna, all the way in the end, crying. It looks like she's wondering, who are all these strangers? Mom, how were you able to do that? Was it your idea to give Shanna away? Was it Dad's? There's so many parts of the story that I still don't get. Okay, I do and I don't. I know that Iona and Ike were well off, and we were poor. I don't doubt that you thought you were giving Shanna a better life and making it a little easier on you and Dad and us. Who doesn't occasionally think of magical ways to make life easier, especially parenting? Then again, you did have another 5 children after that. Did you ever consider asking for Shanna back, like she was more of a rental? I know that Mary had been shipped out to live with them years before, but then came back because Bradley and she were fighting terribly. I probably should have said that Bradley was fighting with her because Mary was unhappy to come back to live with us because she liked her situation there, except for the fighting part. How many kids of yours do you think Aunt Iona needed to feel complete? When you and Dad sent Shanna to live with them, was she just the unlucky one because 5 kids were tough but 6 were too many? Or was she the lucky one? Did it have to be a girl? I know Shanna would visit during the summers and even spend a couple of years with us when she was going to school in Minnesota, but she considered Aunt Iona her mommy and Uncle Ike her daddy. Did that ever bother you? Did you ever regret it? Even a little? Shanna told me that when she lived with Iona and Ike, she had it good. She had everything. She had darling clothes and homemade pinafores from Grandma Bertha, and the trim of her bedspread and pillowcases was crocheted, and she had all the school supplies she needed, which the rest of the Anderson family didn't, and she had a privileged life compared to us, compared to a lot of people. She got to fly in Uncle Ike's very own plane, a Piper Comanche, from South Dakota to the Midwest cities he visited for his business, which was pinball machines and jukeboxes. Sometimes she got sicker than a dog flying in an airplane with him piloting, and Uncle Ike brought those bright blue Dairy Queen cartons to keep in the cockpit in case Shanna threw up. But she still had an adventure unlike anything we poor Andersons had back in the projects of East St. Paul. Which is another part of the story, maybe even the most important part. I don't really understand, Mom. Shanna always stayed in Anderson, even though she was raised by Ike and Iona Pearson, which nobody ever spells right, even if you tell them it has all the vowels but the U, and sometimes Y. She stayed in Anderson because you and Dad didn't let Iona and Ike adopt her, though they wanted to. You 4 grown-ups went for a drive once, and they asked you if they could adopt Shanna, who was very young at the time, and Dad wouldn't have it. And you went along with the decision. I'm not even wondering now about what it's like to give away one of your kids like that. I'm not judging. Who am I to say what it was like to be in your position exactly then? With a raging drunk for a husband and a partner who was often out of work and with so many children? But here's the thing. Dad didn't like Uncle Ike. It might have been that Dad was a little jealous because Uncle Ike was so successful and rich, or because Dad was a veteran and Uncle Ike hadn't served, and Dad was so patriotic that he thought less of Uncle Ike because of it, or because Dad himself was given up for adoption and never recovered from it. But here's really the thing, Mom. Dad would pick on Shannon when she came to visit in Minnesota because she was living with Ike and Iona, as if Shanna had made the decision at the age of 6 months to go do that. Not letting them adopt Shanna really affected her. She got written out of Ike's will. Technically, he left her $1 for reasons she still doesn't know. Because she got divorced and they disapproved of that? Because they thought she spent too much money? And she had no way to contest it because she was an Anderson, not a Pearson. And maybe Dad was right not to like Uncle Ike after all. The very last time Shanna got beaten by her abusive husband, her arm all black and blue from getting kicked, Uncle Ike never said a word to Shanna about it. Never a, that's too bad, or I'm sorry. Never said shit. And Aunt Iona would only say about Shanna's abusive husband, he's a very hard worker, and he makes a good living, and you have a new house. And all that old stupid stuff that people believed in those days. It just seems strange to give your child away to another couple, then have serious reservations about them. Or if you don't have serious reservations, then not to let them adopt and make everything easier. Just another piece of evidence. What is that, Mom? Like 80 trillion? That people are just incredibly complicated? So, yeah, Shanna enjoyed privilege when she was growing up, but got shortchanged later. Her mom, I mean Aunt Iona, Shanna called Aunt Iona Mommy, and you, Mother, left all sorts of glassware and antiques and labeled them with Shanna's name. Shanna told me that after Iona died, Bradley and Aunt Shirley had an estate auction and sold all that stuff without telling Shanna. And then, when Bradley died in his obituary, it said that he was adopted and Shanna felt bad for him because it was the first time she could recall seeing that in an obituary. And she realized how much it must have weighed on him not to know who his biological parents were. Maybe being adopted by a good family and knowing who your birth parents are is the best of both worlds. Weird. Anyway, Mom, Shanna's back in South Dakota after a long time in Minnesota. She left South Dakota years ago because her ex-husband was stalking her. But he died in 1996, at the age of 58, when he went out on a record call to pull a van out of a ditch, and it was 30 below wind chill, and he just keeled over, a heart attack probably. It looked like he had broken three chains trying to get the van out of the ditch. And probably he got worked up, and probably got really mad, and probably he had drunk the night before. And when he drank, it was to get drunk. Anyway, with him gone, Shanna felt that she could return home. The home she called home rather than the first one she came from. She adores her grandkids. A lot changes, Mom, from the time we're babies until the time we're grown-ups. And eras change, but some things don't change. It's got to be emotionally complicated no matter when it happens or why to give away a child or two, even if you still have a huge house full of them. Even if you're doing it to help your sister who can't have them. Even if you think you're giving at least one of your children a better life and doing the whole thing out of love. Seems a little too eeny, meeny, miny, Mom. Or is it just simple, knowing that your sister once said, I always wish I could have kids and my sister had all the kids. Since you passed, we've all missed you terribly. But I have heard Shanna get emotional and say, I miss her, because I really didn't get to spend much time with her growing up. Maybe that's another kind of missing. I don't know. Wondering about the differences between Mom, Mommy, and Mother, Louie. Midwesterners. Hey, Mom. How much do we Andersons keep bottled up that other families would have let out? How much do Minnesotans and Midwesterners keep in, thanks to our famous emotional reserve, the nice way to put it, or repression, not so nice? There's a whole group of jokes called Ole and Lena jokes. You remember them, Mom, right? Ole and Lena, either Swedes or Norwegians transplanted to America, specifically the upper Midwest. I find them so Midwestern, capturing something very true of that sort of American. Stoic, strong, and accepting. Here's one. Ole and Lena had been married 50 years, and suddenly Ole died. Lena went to the office of the local newspaper to put in an obituary. She wrote something down on a piece of paper, handed it to the editor. It read, "Ole's dead." The editor said, "You know you get 5 free words." Lena held out her hand, the editor gave her back the piece of paper, and Lena wrote something more on it, then handed the paper back to the editor. It read, "Ole's dead, vote for sale." If I only had 5 words for your obituary, Mom, they would be, "Mom's gone, my heart's broken." Louie. "70% disabled, pending 100%. Hey, Mom. Remember more than a year ago when I did a meet and greet at the VA hospital in North Las Vegas? After that silent comedy performance I wrote you about, I sat and spoke with many of the vets and took a lot of pictures with them. They're each amazing and inspiring, beautiful and wounded in their own way. Why wouldn't they be wounded? We ask them to do things we're not willing to do ourselves. It's not a video game that they're going into, where you can get killed over and over and over and come back fresh and new. The vast majority of those I met were young men. Boys, really, who served in Iraq or Afghanistan. But there were also some older vets who had served in Vietnam. They're all locals, which is why they're at the VA hospital. Why anyone is usually at their particular VA hospital. Not that I have to tell you, Mom, about veterans. In the end, I sat longest with one young man, Tim, an Army tank sergeant, who got blown up and whose stomach and leg were all messed up. When you looked at him, you couldn't see his wounds, but you could feel his pain. We bonded. Tim said they weren't doing anything for him there. His eyes were pleading. I didn't know how I could help, but I told him I would make some calls. I had met someone high up in the USO. I could try Wounded Warriors. I met Tim's mom, too. She told me that Tim had lots of surgeries, with lots more to come. Her smile was the smile of a sad person. Over the next several months, Tim and I developed a friendship by text. I made calls to the VA, the USO, and Wounded Warriors trying to help address the neglect Tim was complaining about. He was concerned he would be discharged from the hospital's medical unit prematurely before they had a solid plan of care and action for his physical pain, and that he would be moved too quickly to the inpatient psychiatric unit for the mental health treatment he knew he needed. Sometimes he apologized to me for texting so much, but he wrote that he felt out of options. He hoped I would be part of his team on his journey to recovery. I told him I wanted that too. When I could, I distracted him with talk of new comedy material I was developing. He told me that he was so excited to see it when it was ready. I think he appreciated hearing about the nuts and bolts of what I was up to professionally. Once he wrote that he'd been handcuffed and removed from his room because he had refused to go to the psych ward until his pain was managed correctly. Fortunately, another doctor intervened and said Tim should be returned to his room. I don't know why he wasn't getting the proper medical attention. For starters, he needed surgeries on his knee and foot. He got frustrated because a round of CT scans and x-rays had come back normal, yet he knew how much physical pain he was in. Still, they gave him a clear to go. Mom, how many of us have pain that doesn't show up on a scan or an x-ray? How many of us have been cleared to go when we weren't ready? And where, ultimately, was Tim cleared to go? Back home? Back into the world? Back to a different pain bed to lie in? Only doctors and nurses who themselves have served should be taking care of our veterans, I think. Because how can a civilian know what Tim and other vets are feeling? My trauma is sometimes a stubbed toe. I don't mean to sound silly, but I haven't had my stomach blown up or my legs blown off. I don't have a face full of shrapnel. We should be very careful about what we ask people to do for us, especially our veterans, because they aren't just our veterans. They're our neighbors, our friends. They're somebody's brother, sister, father, mother, son, daughter, husband, wife. They're somebody's baby. On top of all of his other difficulties, Tim was having trouble with his disability claim due to financial hardship. A social worker was trying to help him expedite the claim, but Tim grew frustrated and angry enough to want to file a lawsuit against the VA hospital for malpractice and mistreatment. I feel like my country is failing me and I don't know what to do to get the help I need, he texted me. At one point, when I thanked him for his sacrifice and courage, he wrote, I can't speak for others, but at least for me, that's why I served and sacrificed so much. For the people of the United States, for you, your family. It makes me feel humble that you and others recognize the sacrifice and want to give back and help us when we are in our darkest days struggling to live. I continue to share small personal things with him now and then, like when I was coming down with a cold. I thought normalizing things day to day was good. Throughout Tim's odyssey, his will was incredible. I'm getting physically and mentally tougher each day that this shit doesn't kill me, he texted me. I see a pain psychologist as well as my PTSD doc 2 or 3 times a month. I'm now in a pain clinic, and as of this week, got my nerve-blocking injections for my organ damage. Back, knee, and foot. I'm praying that they just amputate it and let me recover with a prosthetic foot. It doesn't work from all the nerve damage, and it's just so painful. He signed the text with his serial number and then 70% disabled, pending 100%. Even when things were gray, his communication exuded optimism and he showed concern for others. Down 3 organs and my whole left leg is done for. Other injuries, but those are the worst. I'm alive and kicking, brother. They can't keep me down forever. Hope your cold is going away. Or, I'm still waiting patiently for my disability to finalize. My mother wanted me to tell you. She said hi. I'm sorry for the loss of your brother, Louis. If there's anything I can do, please let me know. Or, I surely need an attorney to take on the big guys. I'm going to make sure that what happened to me never happens to another veteran again. Mom, we try so hard to be strong, but our reserves are not endless. And sometimes it's easier to be strong for others than for ourselves. Sometimes exhaustion and misery can't just be sloughed off. You can't just sleep off the experience of war. After not hearing from Tim for several months, I received this text from his mom. Louis, this is Tim's mother, Renee. I am contacting you to let you know that Timothy lost his battle with all his pain. I want to thank you for helping him a year ago when he reached out to you for help. They gave us another year with him, and he got amazing mental help from all your help. He did not end his life from the mental part of everything. He simply just could not deal with the horrible pain he endured daily. I just want you to know that that visit made him feel like he was worth something, and I will forever be thankful to you for that. Here's a picture of your visit with him that I put on the wall when we laid him to rest. His phone is getting shut off. If you ever feel like contacting me, here's my number. Also, a page was set up for him on Facebook. Hashtag, our bravest brother Tim, if you ever want to take a peek. Thank you again for giving me another precious year with Timothy. I will forever be thankful. That's all for now, Mom. Love, Louis. Penguin costume time. Hey, Mom. Today I got a final fitting for the tuxedo I'll wear at the Emmys on Sunday night. Beautiful tux, custom made. It fits great. Okay, a little perspective. When I tried it on a few days ago, the suit was a little too big in the shoulders, too loose in the legs, too big in the crotch and the butt. I just don't have enough junk in my trunk. But the incredibly talented costume designer, Amanda Needham, the person who makes Christine Baskets look beautiful week after week, did a phenomenal job. I love what she does. Then this evening, I attended the Vanity Fair pre-Emmy party, Mom. It's the party that everyone wants to go to. They took a photo of me for the magazine. I met a lot of great celebrities, I won't name drop, who were all nice to me. Everyone seems to like the part I play, which means that they would really like you, Mom. I always give you credit. You're having a second life, and way more people could know about you Sunday night when hopefully I'll be walking up those stairs to accept our statuette. I'm going to bed. Sorry to write so brief, but I can't stay up as late as I used to. You like to go to bed early, but you were restless. I could hear you getting up at night and watching TV downstairs, usually the local news or the Tonight Show. I know you liked it mostly for background noise and the light it gives and the fake company it provides. So do I. When I was older and I would come home late, you would be up to say hi and give me that beautiful smile and ask me or Tommy if we were hungry. And of course we always said yes because you'd whip up your signature grilled cheese sandwich, which had way too much cheese and even more butter. Or maybe you'd make a sandwich from slices of pork roast that you had cooked earlier. Now when I get into bed, I follow some of your ritual. I like loose-fitting pajamas, a long-sleeve shirt. A lot of people seem to like sleeping in their underwear, but not me. What if an earthquake hits and you have to go outside? I wear socks to bed like you did because I get cold feet, the real kind of cold feet from the outside air or my own bad circulation. Not the kind that makes people doubt that what they're about to do is what they should do. I think Dad's feet were cold, too. Hot temper, cold feet. And I always have a glass of ice water by the bed, just like you, with a napkin underneath or a coaster so you don't hurt the table. And in case of a heart attack, I keep an aspirin there that I can pop right in. Rosie O'Donnell says having an aspirin nearby once saved her life. Anyway, I gotta get my sleep, Ma. Sunday, I want to look as good as you did. Keep your fingers crossed for me, Mom. I mean for us. Louie. I don't have to smile like I'm happy for someone else. Hey, Mom, we did it! That's the first thing I said when I got up on stage at the Microsoft Theater after they announced Louie Anderson is the winner of the Best Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series. Mom, we did it! Then I said a few more things after putting on my glasses. I have not always been a very good man, but I play one hell of a woman. This is for my mom, Orizella Anderson, who I stole every nuance, shameful look, cruel look, loving look, passive-aggressive line from. I really thank you, Mom. I said a bunch more things, thanking Dad and all my siblings alive and not, and all their spouses. That's a long list to get through, Mom, before that award show orchestra starts getting itchy to play you off stage. So there's a clear disadvantage from being from a family of 11 kids and thanking Zach and Louis C.K. and Jonathan Kreisel and, of course, Abraham and Amos and lots of people on the show and the FX Network and many others. It sounds corny to say that we share these awards with other people, and easy to say since I get to take the trophy home all by myself, unless I'm going to chop it into pieces. And of all the people who share it with me, you're the one who allowed Christine Baskets to happen. You gave me something no one else ever did or could. Life. Winner, winner, chicken dinner, with mashed potatoes and gravy, of course. Your son, Louie. Note to Thomas Wolfe. You never actually leave home. Hey, Mom. We started shooting the second season of Baskets, and on my way to the set early this morning, 5:30 a.m. call, which means in makeup and hair by then, and then start shooting an hour or so later. Still dark outside. I heard the sound of a passing train, which made me think of home in St. Paul. Is it Minnesota I'm thinking of, or childhood? I remember how, when I walked a few blocks from the projects to a certain nearby street, was it Ames Avenue or Ames Street? I often heard that lonesome sound, the clear whistle with purpose, a haunting, beautiful sound. To hear it was to be reminded that someone was passing through your town headed somewhere interesting. If you were ambitious and adventurous and really wanted to get out of St. Paul, the train was probably moving slowly enough that you could jump on. Or most kids could. I was too fat. And why would I ever leave your breakfast, Mom? When I finally left St. Paul, it wasn't because I didn't like it, or even because it was, oh, I don't know, 600 below in the winter. I left it to find my future, my fame, my fortune. Whenever I hear that train sound, I get nostalgic. It's like one of those sounds that takes you out of yourself, like a lone dog barking, or children at recess in a schoolyard. Not long ago, I was back in St. Paul on Minnesota Public Radio, and they introduced me, as often happens, as Louis Anderson from Minneapolis. And I always correct them that I'm from St. Paul. But they'll forget, and later in the conversation, they'll refer to me as being from Minneapolis. St. Paul rarely gets any credit. St. Paul, the other city, true, not the greatest slogan. Either way, Mom, I have lots of fans from Minnesota, and I think they like me partly because I'm so proud and clear about where I come from. The parents of Joe Mauer, the homegrown star of the Twins, once came to see my show, and I was introduced to them afterwards. Go Twins! Then again, I have many Minnesota fans who, in typically direct fashion, tell me exactly how they feel. One man came up to me after the show, shook my hand, and told me he was from Bemidji and said, unsmiling, I don't really care for you, but my wife does. Mom, can we ever really go back home? After my appearance on NPR, I drove around the other city, St. Paul, the place where you and Dad landed, and I headed for our address, 1122 Hazelwood Street. A four-bedroom apartment duplex in the Roosevelt Housing Projects. You said ours was one of the first families to ever move in there, as if it were some badge of honor. As I turned the corner off Maryland onto Hazelwood, there it was, same as ever, mostly. Four-bedroom apartments were available for some young family. Good luck. Mom, you know the woods in front, right? Where all the kids played and we had BB gun fights? And any new development that would destroy that play area mysteriously burned down the moment it looked like something might be finally happening. Still nothing there, Mom. Except memories, of course. Anyway, I looked at the buildings of downtown St. Paul. It's getting better. I can't say it's changed all that much. A few parts were a little dingy and run down. But that's every city. Remember how we were all taught that the James Younger gang, made up of outlaws Jesse James, Frank James, and Cole Younger, and others, used to hide out in St. Paul on the east side off Payne Avenue. The east side was always Italian. It's a wonderful town, St. Paul. A real city, a working man's city. But the streets do seem smaller than the streets of Minneapolis. Minneapolis is nicer and richer, but St. Paul has lots of nooks and crannies. And whenever there are nooks and crannies, there's room for people who don't fit in elsewhere. I see why it's the other city. But that's good. We need other cities and other places. Everyone needs a place to live. Everyone needs a chance. Because of the role in Baskets that Arby's plays, Christine Baskets seriously considers buying one of the local Arby's to run as a family business with sons Chip and Dale. I've been talking to some of the nice people at Arby's about setting up a job training program for young people so they can get jobs there and make some extra money and have better lives. And the Arby's people seem interested. Mom, remember our Arby's, the first fast food drive-thru in our neighborhood? We love driving through and getting an Arby's Jr., a great sandwich. You can still get an Arby's Jr. special, you know. I remember driving with Dad on tax day down 7th Street to the post office mailing our taxes back to the government at the very last minute because the post office would be open till 3 in the morning. I remember driving downtown with Dad, and if I really got lucky, or Tommy was in the car too, and we got really lucky, we would stop at the Coney Island place for a hot dog with the works. Sauerkraut, raw onions, mustard, no ketchup. Maybe 2 if we're really, really, really lucky. And a Coke or a root beer. Hey, Mom, did you know that they once named a hot dog after me at a place called Pink's in Las Vegas? The original Pink's is in L.A. A Louis Anderson was a hot dog with mustard, onions, and sauerkraut. Doesn't that sound delicious? It does to me. Anyway, back to St. Paul. When Tommy and I were kids, we might go with Dad to the KC Hall, that's Knights of Columbus, to play bingo, even though Tommy and I were too young to be there. But no one ever said anything, and we played 3 cards for a dime, with no dabbers. Back then, our markers were lima beans. And Mom, when we got home and you found the beans in Dad's pockets, you threw them at him because he was gambling with what little money we had, even though it was just bingo. Remember Jerry's Chicken, where they came to the car to take your order? And I remember the shopkeeper I bought Red Hots from. I remember the welfare store where we got our clothes and Ames Elementary School, where they lined up normal kids on one side and us project kids on the other. Seriously, who came up with that genius idea? Even then, more than a half century ago, when the world was a different place and we're supposed to appreciate that people in previous eras behaved in different ways and we shouldn't automatically judge them as awful, didn't anyone stop and say, you know what? This seems like a pretty mean, stupid idea. No? No one? Jeez, Louis. My TV family. Hey, Mom. I wanted to tell you about the people I work with. The Baskets crew and cast are extraordinary. So talented, so kind, and I'm beyond lucky to get to work with them. They're like a second family. I really love what I'm doing. Each day I feel like a kid going to his own birthday party. My dedicated assistant is Aida, a lovely woman who makes sure I always have what I need and get where I need. This morning she met me, as she often does, with a hot cup of coffee, lots of powdered creamers, and a side of well-done crispy bacon, which I usually share with hair and makeup. I got to work on time as I always do, though I love to remind people around me, who get there even earlier, look who's on time. In the trailer, they put on my makeup, my wig, and my lipstick. All along, Martha Kelly was in the next chair, getting her makeup and hair done, and she and I started running lines. We had a lot of dialogue in the first scene we were filming. Something in the makeup area smelled like potpourri, as if everyone's grandma had just walked into the trailer. Martha and I had to stop doing lines for a moment because the sound of the blow dryer drowned us out. But then we resumed. It was a cute scene. We were good together. The mix of Christine's oversized personality and Martha's slight one makes a good contrast. It was a very long day of shooting. I was in every scene and had very little downtime. I had one scene with an older actor who looks even older than I know he is. He reminded me of Dad when he was older, and also of Billy, though Billy was quieter, shyer. I tried to be as nurturing as I could with the actor, both as Christine and as Louis. It turned into an even more emotional scene for me because of who the actor made me think of. I was constantly on the verge of tears. God, I miss Billy. But this is what I love so much about Jonathan, the director. He doesn't care how long it takes to get us to where he wants us to go. Yet, he never yells about anything. He just says, yes, let's try another one. He's basically saying, when you stir the thing, stir it a little more like this, maybe. A little more like that. Again, I got emotional because of the way he wanted me to stir it. He knows how to tug on an actor. He's not the only one I'm blessed to work with. Zach's a dream partner, a dream human being. He's genuinely interested in you and any person he's talking to. Me, I couldn't care less. I'm kidding. The crew is full of lovely and welcoming human beings. I try to get to know at least a little bit about all of them. Each of them has a story. Each of them has struggles and such strength in dealing with those struggles to do great professional work. When I get to take a breather, and Zach and Martha do too, and the crew is setting up for the next shot, they have the second team stand in for each of us, background actors with name tags on for the characters they're standing in for. Christine Baskets, Chip Baskets, Dale Baskets, Martha Brooks, and who look vaguely like those they're standing in for. Like I said, it all feels like a second family, almost literally. When we're about to shoot a scene, and somebody yells, "Quiet on the set!" and "Shh!" and everyone is doing their job and no one wants to mess anything up, it doesn't just feel like teamwork and a job well done, but something more. We're bound by love, love and kibitzing. "What color underwear do you think I have on today?" I ask a passing wardrobe person before my first costume change. "She's wrong, it's striped." There's just so many people required to make a show, even a relatively modest cable show like ours. From the person who removes my wig at night, to the people who serve the great food all day, to the people who make sure Christine is wearing the right necklace, to the person who gives me the purse I need, to the person who brings me the chair so I can sit while I'm waiting for the scene to shoot. It's like a family, Mom. When it's going right, it's really going right. And when it's going bad, it's going bad. Jonathan is the dad and Sally Sue Lander, the first assistant director, is the mom. Together they provide structure and guidance. They make sure we all have one thing in mind, which is making something that means something to each of us. Zach's a huge star who could do anything he wants, but he chooses to make a show whose message is ultimately about love, compassion, humanity. We can always use more of that. Things don't always go in the order you expect. You film things out of sequence to save time and money. A crew member with a still camera will frequently pop into our break room to take pictures of us actors for continuity purposes, so that when we're filming at a different location a month from now, Anne Christine is supposed to have just gone from her house to Costco. I'm wearing the same dress and jewelry she was wearing a month before. And in my career, I can say that things haven't always gone in a straight line. Often you have to do one thing to find another. Sometimes you have to do a few things to find a thing that you're meant to be doing. Playing Christine is not just me doing an impression of Orizella. I'm trying to get the essence of her, which means getting at the essence of you and also the essence of me. I also think it expands to the Anderson clan. I think your daughters, as they grew up, were and still are all doing some version of you. And I'm trying to understand the very best and worst of Christine, the heroic things she does, and then the weaker things. Like when she despairs enough, slips enough, that she retreats to her room to half lie on her bed, propped up on one elbow while eating gigantic spoonfuls of Cool Whip. I remember when Dad would be raging on you and you would retreat to the bedroom to watch TV. I'm just doing my best to play this woman as the realest person she is, the way she exhales with her whole body. Jimmy says Christine reminds him most of you when she's consoling her kids, when she's trying to cheer them up. But Shanna says Christine reminds her most of you when Christine is scolding or shaming her kids a bit. "That one look she used to get when she didn't like something, you captured it, Louie," says Shanna. She says just seeing me dressed like a woman reminds her of you, period. Even if Christine never said a thing. I don't know how many people watch our beautiful little show. But who knows anymore how to measure a show's popularity with DVRing and streaming? Never mind, Mom. It's like VHS, but better. I feel as if those who do watch it love it. Winning the Emmy helped, and if I can get nominated again and maybe win again, and if Zach can get nominated, which he absolutely deserves, then that might buy us more time regardless of any ratings. I think our viewers love the show because they get the characters. Personally, I feel fortunate and relevant. Not that I felt irrelevant before this came along, but it's exhilarating to be part of such an original, strange hybrid of a show. It's an adult family comedy. It's slapstick drama. It's got a lot of Charlie Chaplin's melancholy, and hopefully a lot of his humor too. It's all in the family with more mental illness and work instability. It upsets people in a good way, a way that says we're part of the human race, and that most of our endeavors, even when we mean well, won't work out. It's about people who in real life would be thought of as dysfunctional or partly dysfunctional, yet who still do their very best to function once in a blue moon. And Christine gets to be the MC, master of chaos. My favorite line from Baskets might be, "I'm your mother." Do you know what that means? Does that mean anything to you? You mean something to me, Mom. Louis. Big and Beautiful. Hey, Mom. Once I had an idea for a line of men's shirts with the stains already on them. A little mustard on the chest, some spittle around the collar, sweat stains. Life shirts, I was going to call them. I wasn't serious, but I really do want to do a line of clothes for QVC or Home Shopping Network called Big and Beautiful, or Big Essentials, or maybe Orizella. Featuring clothes that Christine Baskets has worn on the show or could wear or dreams about wearing. I modeled the clothes as Christine. She's the spokesperson. You're the inspiration, Mom. What do you think? I bet the phones wouldn't stop ringing. I'm not saying that tens of millions of healthy-sized women are watching Baskets, but the same thing that our viewers respond to would be true for the people who've never even heard of our show. Some people come up to me and say, "I love you in buckets." I never correct them. After the pilot, when we got picked up for season one, I went through the wardrobe and helped the costume people select clothes. My mom would wear this, my sisters would love that. I tried them all on. If it were something you or the girls would wear, I picked it out. Really colorful clothes, lots of prints and floral. Essentially, what a person who doesn't have a lot of money thinks is really fancy. Is that not a nice thing to say? I don't mean it that way. I see Christine as a real American, a big American woman, and that's how she dresses. I remember how soft your clothes were. I think your fashion sense was ahead of its time. You wore pantsuits. And I liked your appreciation when you had on the right thing. "I look so good in it," you'd sometimes said. Because you did, Mom. I slowly disappear when I go into the makeup and hair trailer. I'm not used to slowly disappearing, ever. When the makeup and the wig go on, I become Christine. And once I'm transformed, I see clothes as Christine would see them.
The people who dress me, each one of them has an incredible eye, whether it's for the caftans or the Easter bonnet or the jewelry.
And I become more sure and demanding, yes, demanding, of my fashion wants and needs. "Give me some pockets. Wait, this is see-through. You'll see right through that." I appreciate a great find, just like you did. Don't you love a good bathrobe? Oh, how I love these pajamas. They're so Christine. I understand about women lending jewelry to each other, comparing outfits with other women on the show. Whoa, other women?
I have to remember, I'm not a woman. I mean, comparing outfits with women. Full stop.
Sometimes I can get almost cranky about it. Once I was given some pajamas, big and comfy, and then somehow they got altered and suddenly they were too small, and then there was no waistband, and the crotch was not right. Do women talk like that? It shouldn't go straight like that. But I told myself I wasn't going to complain. I didn't want to be a diva. Christine Baskets as diva. Well, she has a little bit of that in her. And I think I have a little bit of it in me. I see my transformation into Christine and think of what the great divine did, or what Jeffrey Tambor has done in Transparent. Mom, I'm just trying to make myself completely disappear and make you appear. More and more, I'm turning into Christine. I look in the mirror and I can't take my eyes off you, like the song says. And when I have seen clips of me, I see that I've completely disappeared in the part. Can I say this? I'm sort of mesmerized. I don't kid myself that I, Louis, am such a dreamboat, even though Ken on the show is clearly and believably attracted to Christine.
I mean, in my wig, I look a bit like I'm with the Mormons, and I certainly perspire a lot in my makeup, but sometimes you can't take your eyes off her. I wanted the editors to splice together clips of Christine in slow-mo and wearing different outfits and busy at different activities, set to Can't Take My Eyes Off of You by Frankie Valli. I used to open for Frankie in Vegas. Such a great, sweet guy, and can he still sing? I thought I could convince him to do it for me. You know, a clip that would go viral. A different application of Viral Mom, but similar idea. Don't you think I should do a line of Christine's clothes? I truly think she's as legitimate a fashion icon as anyone out there. In the meantime, Mom, they have a great leopard jacket for me this season. Just call the number on the bottom of the screen. Operators are standing by. Oh, there goes another jacket. Dressing smartly, Louie. Older. Hey, Mom, I need a new knee. I tweaked it on the set today. Not too bad, but they gave me some ice for it. It happened in a scene with Zach where we're sitting across from each other at the dining room table. And after it was over, I just stood up wrong. I joke with the crew, Zach kicked me, and you guys all saw it, right? Fact is, lately when I walk, the knee bothers me a little bit. There are 21 steps leading up to the front door of my house in Vegas. A couple of years ago, after working on a show, I slipped on the floor by the elevators. Somebody from the restaurant spilled grease there. I sued them, they settled, but I need a new knee. The doctor told me this one's pretty much bone on bone, no cartilage, not even butter. Maybe the other one, too. It's not surprising because these knees were made for a smaller model. They did not plan for this. I need ones made of titanium. Though first I need to lose at least 50 pounds so that the rehab won't be so difficult. I need to avoid craft services. I've been pretty good about that, actually. I could say all the bad things about getting older. First, we just try to hide it, as if it's not really happening to us and to everyone every second of every day. When I was 58 years old, I like to say, I just turned 58 years ago. Well, now I'm 63 years old, Mom. So I just turned 58 years ago, 5 years ago. I remember when you turned 50, Mom, and Tommy and I just stared at you. What? Dad was 51 when I was born. When you hit 50, time moves faster. It does. And every body part starts clicking. I try to focus on the good parts of aging. When you pass 50, you say things like, this is the best bowl of soup I ever had in my life. Can I have a gallon of soup to take home? Why am I talking about what it's like to hit 50 when I'm in my 60s? Denial. Then again, who wants to live forever? If you live to 1,000... you wouldn't be able to retire until you're like 700. When you're young, you do drugs that could kill you. When you get old, you just want drugs that'll keep you alive. Full circle, baby. Mom, I don't know which is the most important thing about age. What age you are, or how old you feel in relation to those around you? Do we feel old because we feel old, or because everyone around us suddenly looks so young that, God, do we feel old? I feel so lucky to be working at age 63 on a great TV show. I'm surrounded by 20-somethings and 30-somethings, and they still talk to me.
Yay!
Sometimes I feel as if we're just way too focused on younger people. I doubt that I would have ever argued that when I was one of them. I mean, there are millions and millions of people out there who are my age, who have money and who want to buy things. But most of the movies and TV shows are not made for them. It's trite to say, but at any age, we only want one thing ever. Just one. Human connection. And a decent cup of coffee. Anyone who tells you otherwise doesn't get what's really behind whatever else they're seeking. Money, power, sex, bigger boobs, a nice Gustav Stickley 1905 lunch table, whatever. I think of an old lady who meant a lot to me when I was a young man. It was the first apartment building I lived in Los Angeles in North Hollywood, after moving there from Minneapolis. I knew I had to be in L.A. if I wanted a real shot at making it in comedy and show business. And I befriended a very old woman named Sylvia, who lived in the apartment next door to mine. I just started to get a little bit of success, and I had my first appearance on The Tonight Show.